some of my songs I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's Tuesday, May 3rd, 2011, and I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43, joined by my co-host tonight, special guest filling in, Jen Swartman from the Blind Tiger.
Hi, Jimmy.
How are you, Jen?
I'm doing really well. I kind of like taking over Ray's chair here.
Well, you know, Ray Dieter's down in New Orleans taking care of his bars in New Orleans and hanging out at Jazz Fest.
He's not suffering. I'm happy to be here because this is going to be a fantastic show.
It's definitely going to be great. We're sponsored by greatbrewers.com. Thanks to them. Check out more about beer education. Get your test on the Great Beer Test. And check out their mobile app, The Beer Cloud, greatbrewers.com. We're also supported by the people at the Good Beer Seal, an association of 27 New York City beer bars that serve, promote, and support good beer. To learn more, check out goodbeerseal.com. If you have any questions, you can email us at beersessions@gmail.com. And to call in for a live talk at our studio, 718-497-2128. Well, we're joined by a very special guest today. We've got Sam Merritt, who's our beer sommelier, who at one time worked for Brooklyn Brewery. And we have Steve Hindy, who is the founder and owner of Brooklyn Brewery. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jimmy. Good to be here.
Yeah, we've wanted to have you on for a long time. There's so many new people in beer and the new generation. How does it feel being one of the original guys?
Well, it's fascinating what's happening today. You know, there are more than 1,700 breweries across the country today. And at the Craft Brewers Festival in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, there were 600 guys who were and women who were talking about starting breweries. So, you know, I think this whole thing has only just begun.
Jen, were you at the Craft Brewers Conference?
I sure was. And they had I can't even remember what the percentage increase on attendance for that thing was, but it was thousands of people more than in the past. Unbelievable. So that means not only 600 people who are thinking of starting new breweries up, but just the attendance from the breweries who have, you know, come into existence was phenomenal. And it was actually really remarkable that they were able to handle that size growth with an event like that. But it was so much fun.
There were 4,000 people there this year, and I think the previous record was like 2,700.
Yeah. Incredible.
Really amazing. And the enthusiasm of the new generation of brewers is fantastic. I mean, it's inspiring.
Yeah, to everyone who's been involved for a while.
So, Steve, when you started Brooklyn Brewery, it was a different time. Tell us a little more about it and what got you interested in craft beer in the first place.
Well, you know, all of us craft brewers came from different lives before we got into brewing. And my life was maybe a little unusual. I was a journalist for the first 15 years of my working life. And six of those years were in the Middle East. I was the AP correspondent in Beirut for 3 years and Cairo for 3 years. In the late 70s, early 80s. So I covered a lot of big stories. I was in Iran for the revolution and the hostage crisis. Eventually, I got expelled from Iran. I went back in with the Iraqi army when they invaded Iran in 1980. And then, you know, in Lebanon, we had the civil war, we had the Israeli invasion, the massacres in the refugee camps. I covered all those stories. I was actually abducted at one point in South Lebanon, a very nasty incident where the people with me were tortured and killed. They were UN peacekeeping troops. I moved to Cairo, and I was sitting behind President Sadat when he was killed at the parade in 1981. So a lot of big stories, but amazingly, the biggest impact on my life was meeting American diplomats in Cairo who had been in Saudi Arabia, where they have Islamic law, you can't buy alcoholic beverages. And there's an incredible long tradition of homebrewing in Saudi Arabia among the expats. Actually, I learned that the Saudis didn't officially ban alcoholic beverages till 1954, when all the foreigners were Americans mostly, coming in to develop the oil fields. So when they banned it, Aramco, the Arab American Oil Company, issued a pamphlet to all its employees telling them how to make their own beer at home, because they knew these roughneck oil workers, I mean, they're not going to come to Saudi Arabia no matter how much you pay them if they can't have a beer at the end of the day. So I got into making my own beer, and then my wife got fed up with being the wife of a war correspondent, and she said, I've had enough of this, I'm going back to the city, I'm taking my kids, our kids, hope you join me, but if not, have a nice life. So, you know, it was one of those moments where you got your career and your family, and I decided to stick with my family, and I came back to New York, and settled in Brooklyn, went to work for Newsday doing the foreign news for them, and I was making beer at home, serving it to all my friends and neighbors. And my downstairs neighbor, Tom Potter, was a banker with an MBA who'd always wanted to start his own business. And so the summer of 1986, when the Mets went on to win the World Series, Tom and I drank a lot of homebrew on the weekends. We'd sit in his backyard watching this little beat-up black and white TV. And I was dreaming of starting a brewery. And Tom thought it was a ridiculous idea. He had studied the beer industry in business school, and he said, you know, the big are getting bigger, the distributors are getting bigger, everything's consolidating. How are we possibly going to break into that business? And I said, well, we're not going to make Budweiser, we're not going to make Miller, we're not going to make Coors Light. We're going to make beers with flavor, beers with character, beers that compete with the imported beers that we drink. Actually, Tom went to the Craft Brewers Conference in 1986 in Oregon. At that time, there were less than 100 people at the conference. Wow. There were only 25 small breweries in the country. And there's Tom Potter from Brooklyn with a Brooks Brothers suit, a banker from New York. They all wanted to talk to him because they thought, you know, this guy could be a source of financing, not realizing that by the end of the conference, Tom came back and was ready to start a brewery with me.
All right.
Yeah, that worked out well.
Yeah, we got Sam here who knows all about you. Let's think a couple more things. So one of the seminal people that you met, there's a story about this author, Will Anderson. Tell us about how you met him and how he influenced you.
Yeah, that Will, actually, I was jogging in Prospect Park. It was, I don't know, it was like the spring of 87, I think, and maybe 86. And it was kind of a gloomy day, and, you know, I'm kind of running around. Running's not fun except when you're done, because then the beer tastes better. But I was, you know, kind of had my head down, kind of trudging around the park. And I passed this guy who had a sweaty old T-shirt that said Breweries of Brooklyn across the front. And I'm not that quick a person, so I didn't really react, but it kind of like, whoa, what was that, you know? And then I passed him again on the other side of the park, and I stopped him, and I said, hey, what's with the T-shirt? And Will's a crotchety kind of guy. I don't know if you ever met him, but he said, well, it's a book I wrote. It's out of print. And I said, well, I'm thinking about starting a brewery. And he said, yeah, you and everybody else. And I said, well, you know, what about your book? And he said, oh, you know, you can't find it now. And I said, well, do you have a copy? And he said, yeah, I do. I only have one left. And I said, well, you know, could I look at it? And he said, well, oh, okay. So he invited me over to his house. And interestingly, he lived on Garfield Street in Park Slope. And he was he was fed up with Brooklyn. He said, Brooklyn's gone to hell. I'm getting out of here, you know. And actually, he ended up moving to Maine, Portland, Maine, which is where he still lives. And of course, Brooklyn did not go to hell. Quite the contrary. But that book really made me an instant expert on the history of brewing in Brooklyn. He profiles about 18 of the old Brooklyn breweries, many of which are still, the buildings are still standing here in Bushwick and other parts of Brooklyn.
So we're out here in Bushwick now. How many breweries were in this neighborhood in the 1800s?
Well, Brooklyn in 1898, when it became part of New York City, had 48 working breweries, and most of them were concentrated in this area. Actually, our first warehouse was in the old Otto Huber Brewery on Messerol and Bushwick Place, right off Bushwick Avenue. And that building is still standing. I think there's a noodle factory there or something now.
Was there a reason why this area was chosen? Was there better water access or
yes,
something like that?
The reason was water. You know, the Brooklyn Queens Aquifer, the springs on the Brooklyn Queens border, were the source of water for most of the breweries starting in like the, you know, early 1800s. And then actually one of the reasons I think that Brooklyn eventually became part of New York City is Brooklyn was a big industrial center, and that groundwater eventually became polluted. And part of the motivation for Brooklyn becoming part of New York City was to get access to the water from the Croton Aqueduct in the Catskills in the Delaware River Basin.
Huh. So it's all about water. And back then, what did they do with the waste from the brewery?
That's a good question, you know. I bet they just pumped it right into the sewers, I suspect. Yeah.
It's pretty good.
How many barrels of water does it take to make one barrel of beer on average?
Sam, what are you laying a Cicerone question on me?
Yes, I am.
No, the environmental impact of a brewery is great, Steve, and you know, you guys at Brooklyn taught me that right away. But the amount of pollution that was going on at the time, it was very swift. And I remember when selling Brooklyn beer and promoting Brooklyn beer, I on numerous occasions got jokingly, people would say, "Where do you get that water?" You know, from the East River. And then I would turn straight to the bagels and the pizza of New York. And I say, if anybody studies the bagels and the pizza of New York and the dough that they use, they say it's the water. And that kind of ends that. I mean,
you didn't tell them it was the Gowanus Canal.
But it probably...
No, no, not the Gowanus Canal.
But the breweries then were probably polluting their source of water.
It wasn't just the breweries. There were huge metal plating businesses.
That'll
there were a lot
it.
Of foundries. You know, the breweries were the least of the problems for the pollution of Brooklyn.
All right. And Ray, are you on the phone right now?
Ray, I'm here.
How are you, Ray?
East Louisiana, right as we speak.
I miss you, buddy.
Oh, you can shucks, I miss you too, Jim.
Join in at any time. We got a long show coming up. We wanted to make sure that we got a chance to talk to Steve a little bit, get a little background. We got a very lively show.
Hey, Steve, how you doing, man?
Good, Ray. How are you? I envy you. You're down there for Jazz Fest, right?
I
know.
Yes,
I'm sure
Tom
you're
Jones
working
this weekend.
Hard.
He was great.
Cool.
So what are some of the observations from Jazz Fest, Ray?
Oh, God.
What
well,
are you drinking?
It was a fun time, and they actually have one good beer available at Jazz Fest, and it's called Pilsner Urquell, which I guess you all know about that beer from...
I've heard of that.
You heard of that? Yeah, that's basically the best beer they have available at the festival. But, you know, I'm at DBA right now, at the DBA on Frenchman Street, 618 Frenchman Street in New Orleans, and I just, like, got educated. There's a ton of great beers available here.
What new beer have you tried that you can't get here that you love?
A beer, honest to God, this is a great, subtle Kolsch beer from a brewery called Heinerbrau, H-E-I-N-E-R, capital B-R-A-U, Heinerbrau.
Huh.
And they make a Kolsch, and I've had a ton of Kolsches that they don't get it. I've been to Germany, I've had Kolsches. This, they got it. It's subtle.
Yeah.
All right.
Walty. It's a lovely beer. I've never heard of it before. I never
and
heard of it.
And good in the heat, too, I'm sure.
Beg your pardon?
And good in the heat.
Yes,
it exactly. Sounds beautiful, man. Listen, we're all going to regroup for a minute. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more with our guests about local Brooklyn history. We'll be back on Beer Sessions Radio. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This weekend is Mother's Day, and many moms will be receiving that ubiquitous box of chocolates. This year, show mom you actually put thought into her box of chocolates by pairing it with a great beer. Our beer sommelier, Sam Merritt, is here to help you out. Sam, what beer would you give mom with her box of chocolates?
Well, I would make the chocolates, of course, myself, but I think...
Since when?
I think the ultimate chocolate beers, if you're going to please your mom, would be the fruited lambics, especially the red fruits, the raspberries and the cherries. They go great with everything chocolate. I did bring a bacon chocolate bar today in honor of Steve. I brought the black chocolate stout and this bacon chocolate bar, and there's a lot of resonance, you know, with that, but I think for mom, Mother's Day, you got to pick the Creeks and the Lambics.
David from Urban Oyster Tours, what would you serve mom?
I think I'd have to go with that Brooklyn Black Chocolate Stout. We just did a chocolate and beer pairing not too long ago at DBA with Ray there, and we served a number of beers, served the Bone.
Yes.
Yeah, which was really popular. And then the black chocolate stout, I think, got the highest votes at the tasting. So.
And one of the first beer cocktails I've ever come across where we were at the beer bar in Grand Centro in 1997. And Steve gave me a mixture of black chocolate stout and Lindeman's Creek. And I wanted to name it the Brooklyn Valentine, but it went out as the black and red, the red and black. Sorry, Steve, but it was awesome and got me really into thinking about blending beers and stuff.
Yeah, and not just chocolate too, but you can actually make dinner for mom. You know, I marinated a pork roast in black chocolate stout a few weeks ago. That came out very nicely.
All right. Well, Sam, since we have Steve Hindy here, tell us what it was like when you first worked at Brooklyn Brewery. So Steve, Steve and Tom founded Brooklyn Brewery, and at some point you guys got Garrett Oliver.
Garrett came on in 1994. Yep.
And then they built the brewery in Brooklyn in 96. 96. And I came in the fall of 96, and I was a very unhappy salesman working selling print advertising, which I strongly recommend no one does. But I saw an ad in the New York Times. It was a half inch ad, and you know, there was no monster.com back there then or anything. And so if you wanted a new job in New York, you got the New York Times on Sunday and you used a little pen and you sent your resume that way. And so it just said Brooklyn Brewery salespeople wanted. And it had the phone number, and I called right away, and I couldn't believe that they advertised beer jobs in the first place. And then it was so close by. So I went and I talked to a guy named Jim Munson. And the second person I ever met in the beer business was Steve Hindy. And I remember sitting across the desk from him and just saying, you know, I'm not an axe murderer. I'll sell your beer. I'm really into beer. And it was awesome. And, you know, that was 15 years ago. And I got a lot of respect for these people. And it was a really good learning experience. We sold beer through education before anybody else. And that's how we sold beer. It wasn't giving beer away. It was teaching people about what beer was and then opening up all these new doors for everybody. And it was a gorgeous experience. And if it wasn't for the Brooklyn Brewery,
Ray Talker from New Orleans,
wouldn't have civilization.
Steve and those guys never, ever gave beer away. That's for sure.
What did he say?
That's Ray. Sorry,
Sam can't hear you, Ray.
I can't hear you, Ray. And you're lucky.
Well, Steve, what was it like for you? You know, back in those, you were a founder or owner. You were hands on. Did you do everything? What were some of your jobs in the early days?
Well, you know, in the early days, we distributed our own beer, which was different than most of the other breweries around the country. And so, you know, we drove the truck, we delivered the beer, we collected the money. We really kind of learned the business from the ground up that way. It was tough, you know. Actually, in the beginning, I calculated the first year, it took 7 visits to each to sell a customer on average. So it wasn't like we walked in and said, hey, we have this beer called Brooklyn Lager, and people jumped right on it.
Sometimes it took years, right, Steve?
Hey, I mean, Steve, you
would have me go to some of these accounts for years and then finally get the customer.
Yeah, right.
Hey, Hindi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, so I remember going to, like, street fairs in Brooklyn and seeing, like, Brooklyn Lager bottles at these street fairs. And I was like, where did this come from? And I had no idea where it came from. Were you, like, doing that before you were distributing to bars and stuff?
No, we did that. We did that from the beginning. Actually, that was probably our most effective marketing program was selling beer at street fairs. So, I mean, during the week we were out peddling beer, you know, trying to sell beer door to door, and we couldn't afford to give people credit, so it was all COD. And then on the weekends we'd work these street fairs, usually on Saturday and Sunday. And they were great because, you know, we got a lot of people to sample the beer, but more importantly, we got paid in cash, and it really helped us keep going.
So then at what point did you start distributing other brands? Because you ended up with quite a distributorship, too.
We started out distributing our own beer, actually on the advice of a woman entrepreneur named Sophia Collier, who was one of our neighbors in Brooklyn. And she had started a company called Soho Natural Soda. So in the very beginning, Sophia was selling her company to Seagram's for $22 million the year that we started in business. And I stopped her on the block one day and said, hey, would you mind giving my partner and I some advice about the beer business? So she came over on a Saturday morning and, you know, we poured some of our beer. We had a sample. We had a test batch. And we showed her the logo. And she said, wow, this is great. You know, the logo's great. The beer's great. But, you know, it's not going to work unless you distribute your own beer. And I remember thinking, distribute beer in New York City? You know, I can hardly afford my car insurance. I'm going to insure a truck, you know, and you know, what about parking tickets? And what about the mafia, for God's sake? I mean, we are in Brooklyn here. And she said, yeah, you know, there are a lot of problems. But she told us she started out with Soho and tried to sell it through health food distributors, failed. Tried soda distributors, failed. Tried beer distributors, failed. And she said, I didn't sell my brand until I put it in the van, put my logo on the van, and went out there and peddled it.
Because it was misunderstood.
No one was really selling it. They were just saying, hey, I got this new thing. The same way they do today, actually. So we started distributing our own beer. And actually, after, it was like 18 months, we began to see that this could be a business. And other brands, other craft breweries, American craft breweries, actually Dock Street in Philadelphia was one of the first who came to us and said, hey, you know, we're totally striking out with these distributors. Why don't you guys distribute our beer? And we said, well, you know, we compete against you. And they said, yeah, but, and we began to think about it and thought, well, you know, we can't really make it just selling Brooklyn Lager. Let's take on some other brands. And we did, and it was like, it was unbelievable. All of the craft breweries, American craft breweries and European craft breweries, came to us within a matter of 6 months.
Yeah, they had all been going through the same thing. Everyone quietly had been suffering through the market, I'm sure.
I think that because of what you guys did, like I know Ray started DBA, he's trying to come on right now. And my first restaurant, our little restaurant in the East Village, Muggsy's Chow Chow, it was because of you guys that I learned about beer. I mean, without that selection, and also it was like you guys were really unique. I mean, there was some care that was given. You guys were locally based. Your salesmen were all great. So, yeah. I mean, all the beers I know that I love, I had through your Craft Brewers Guild. So, thank you, man.
Thank you very much. Great beer to sell alongside all these other imports. Great imports like Bateman's and Fuller's and the Merchant Devin line, the B United line. And to be able to put Chimay on the same hand truck as Brooklyn Lager really, really helped. And also, you know, it costs so much money just to stop a truck and to do a delivery in New York. There, you know, to introduce a new brand, as Brooklyn was a new brand back then, to be able to say, oh, yes, and by the way, we have all these other beers, and Brooklyn is as good. And
I want to make one thing clear, Sam. Brooklyn developed the network, and then we sold those other beers into those accounts.
Sure.
Eventually, the package we had did contribute to the growth of Brooklyn, but it was really the network we developed with Brooklyn that enabled us to sell all those other brands into the market.
And Steve, I mean, one of the things that amazed me back then is your sales force. I mean, those guys and girls knew their beer, and that was what huge. It's like when they came into me, I was learning back then as well, back in, you know what, you put up in 94, and to have a sales force that, like, yeah, here's what a Trappist Ale is, yes, here's what, you know, an English IPA is or American IPA is, and your guys on the ground absolutely knew their stuff, and that was I think integral for everybody.
Ray, did you sell a lot of Brooklyn beers back in the 90s?
Yes, I did. In the early days, I did, yeah. But the funny thing happened, and Steve and I have had our ins and outs about this. It was like, it got to a point that people came to DBA, and they weren't interested in drinking, like, craft beer that they knew about, because Brooklyn became so successful. It was available in multiple bars, all the places, all the time, and I couldn't shift it that much, and they were looking for more exotic beers. Happened with Sierra Nevada, those, like, kind of, like, we talked about this before, gateway beers. And Brooklyn is one of the classic gateway beers. It's really an easy beer to drink. It's a great beer to go from Budweiser to Brooklyn Lager. It's a cinch, and you can't go back after you tried it.
All right. And now, Steve, you guys have come so far, and we're jump ahead. I mean, the next big news is you guys expanded the brewery.
Yep.
And there's a lot of things that are going to happen from that. Tell us some of your goals and ambitions for the new brewery.
You know, Ray just hit on a big problem we have now, which is, and actually a lot of the craft brewers around the country who have been successful have the same problem, which is you're viewed as like really big and really successful, and you know, the craft beer consumer is looking for something special, something new. So, you know, those two aren't always compatible. So we've in the last, I'd say, 5-6 years, really worked hard to develop specialty beers beyond Brooklyn Lager. Brooklyn
Lager's, and you've done a phenomenal job with that, too.
Oh,
Garrett has done an incredible job. Yeah.
Jen, what are your favorite Brooklyn
beers?
Well,
we had an incredible Brooklyn event at Blind Tiger just, within the last month. And we had the vast majority of the kegs we had on draft were vintage because they were remaining kegs from one-offs that had been done over the years. And to see those beers, I tried them when they were brand new, and they were wonderful then. But then to see how they've been so well-aged and how so many flavors have melded together, I mean, just really a testament to what they're capable of over there as far as like really complex, amazing flavors. So I like the fact that they have, in the beer market, I think you successfully have managed to have two identities almost now. And not that you want to be a split personality, but Brooklyn Lager can be everywhere and serve that market, and people identify it, people ask for it by name. People come to the Tiger and they ask for that beer. Although we also are where Ray is, where we, you know, people expect us to have something that's not everywhere. But then now the Brewmaster Series, the respect that you've regained from all the beer geeks, and there are more and more beer geeks every day as we turn our heads.
What does that mean?
They walk among us.
We're beer geeks. Steve, I hate to ask you to pick favorites, but what's one of the favorites of the Reserve Series that you like?
Well, I really got a kick out of the Manhattan.
That's
project.
My favorite.
That was fun. You know, I teased Garrett. I said, Garrett, the only reason you made this beer is because you don't want to make a fruit beer, but this is really a cherry beer. Of course, it's a lot more than that. That beer is made, it's a rye beer, a strong rye beer, that we age in Rittenhouse rye whiskey barrels for 4 months. And we add the kind of herbs that are in sweet vermouth and bitters, and we add organic sour cherry juice. And so the beer, in the end, smells and tastes like a Manhattan.
See, and I've got to say, because I talk about this all the time when it comes to flavored beers, I decided exactly where the line was drawn a couple of years ago, and I was like, it's so simple. If you use actual food products, it's a whole different story than if you cheat and you go to New Jersey Flavor Science and you get an extract from some lab that's created some flavoring that's like a fruit. And so, you know, to take on the challenge of using actual food products and leave it to Garrett, who is an incredible authority on food and food and beer, for him to then break apart what is it that makes a Manhattan cocktail a Manhattan and how can he successfully incorporate that into a beer is just magic. And that's why that beer, the first time I tried it, it was a little too much for me. It was too sweet.
Can I just say something?
Yeah, sure.
Leave New Jersey out of this, okay?
Oh, I'm sorry.
So that's where
I'm sitting in your chair. I should be respectful.
The perfume companies started the industry.
I know. But it's not New Jersey's
fault. Which is also natural.
Oh, come on. So there's a hook.
It started in Jersey.
But anyway, to get back to it, when I had the Manhattan Project at the GABF 2 years ago, 2009, I think that was one of the main beers you guys were pouring, I tried it, yeah, out of reverence and respect. And it was, I think that was, for me, that was the perfect mark. I mean, it was delicious when I had it a few weeks ago at the Blind Tiger, but it
did you all have a keg of that?
Yeah, we did. Oh, I mean, wow. We had such an incredible list, and people were just marveling. And I had to go. We didn't have it. Unfortunately, we didn't have a list that told us the years when everything was made. I would have liked to have marked them because I think a lot of people didn't even realize that these were one-off batches, that you hadn't just redone the Cuvée de Cardoz, which is another one of my favorites with the Indian spices. Absolutely beautiful.
Well, yeah, actually, one of the reasons we expanded the brewery is because that part of our business, the specialty beers, are exploding in growth. So one of the problems we had with the Brewmaster's Reserve Series was the demand was far greater than our ability to produce. Now with the new brew house and the new fermenters, we're able to make more of that. So we're going to be bringing the Manhattan Project back, even though it's a murderous beer to make. I mean, it's really difficult to make. But we'll come back with that because people can't stop talking about it.
Okay, guys, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back talking more with Steve Hindy and Sam Merritt and the crew on Beer Sessions Radio.
Mrs. Jones. We got a thing going on. Both know that it's wrong, but it's much too strong to let it go now. We meet every day at the same cafe, 6:30, and no one knows she'll be there. Holding hands, making all kinds of plans, while the jukebox plays our favorite song. Me and Mrs. Jones. We got a thing.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to Hot Grease every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Hot Grease strives to bring sustainability, localized sourcing, and other forward-thinking schools of culinary thought to the minds and kitchens of everyday folk. Each week, Nicole Taylor's conversations cover the entire spectrum of food enthusiasts, from internationally renowned culinary masters to moms on a budget looking to impress their tiniest critics. Again, that's every Monday at 3:30 p.m., Hot Grease on the Heritage Radio Network.
All right. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio. Thank you, Nicole Taylor and Hot Grease. Check it out on Heritage Radio Network. We're very happy to be on this network. We got a great guest tonight, Steve Hindy from Brooklyn Brewery, Sam Merritt. We're talking about some of the really great beers coming out of Brooklyn Brewery. So, Steve, tell us about one of your favorite beers, Sriracha Ace.
Yeah, Sriracha Ace is a saison style, which I think is one of the favorites among all the brewers at the Brooklyn Brewery. It's made with the hop from the Sriracha region of the northern Japanese island of Hokkaido. It was developed by Sapporo, the Sapporo Brewery, and it has so much flavor and aroma that they decided not to use it. And it's now being grown in Oregon by one farmer. And Garrett fell in love with this hop and thought it would marry beautifully with a Saison-style beer. So that's how Sriracha Ace was born. And we released it a year ago as a special and Brewmaster's Reserve. It was incredibly successful. Then we put it in bottles, and people loved it. You know, men, women, people who don't like beer, everyone was turned on by this beer. So this spring, with our new brew house, we're able to bring it back, and it's going to become a year-round product. And I would not be surprised to see this, outsell Local 1 and Local 2 and the other great beers that that we're making here in Brooklyn in the 750 bottles.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Is it a single hop beer
yes.
then? Okay,
yeah.
So it's 100% Sriracha.
It's 100% Sriracha Ace, yeah.
Yeah. And do we know of any other breweries who have used Sriracha? I mean, it is so specific. It's so distinctive.
I know Dick Cantwell at the Elysian Brewery in Seattle. He's done a beer with it. I think maybe we kind of cornered the market on the hop for this year. So
does it bring a citrus spice? I mean, is that
smell it, taste it.
I mean,
it smells like lemongrass, lemon verbena.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just it's a really delightful aroma and flavor.
Yeah, it's not like a hoppy thing that you get with a Sierra Nevada, where it's a West Coast piney citrus
perfuminess to it.
Yeah.
I mean, but not in any sort of artificial way, like a natural, like
it's kind
like
of
we're saying, like
it's
verbena.
Kind of spicy, like a Saaz hop might be, in a Czech Pilsner.
We should definitely do a show soon just about hops, because You know, people think
we say that
when you hear
show.
Hops, you think, and I've got David and Cindy here from Urban Oyster. We want to make sure we get a little chance to talk to them. They do great beer tours, and they know a lot about beer as well. You guys should get on the mic,
yeah,
too.
Grab that mic.
But let's jump into this talk about hops, because it often comes up at my bar, Jimmy's Number 43. You know, there might be a hopped, you know, beer that might be something from Belgium. You know, it might not be what people expect, or they see hop and they don't want to buy it. So let's have a little talk about hops. David, in all your experience as UrbanOyster.com, what do your guests think about hops?
Well, you know, we get a chance to work with a lot of the people that come on our tours, either our Brewed in Brooklyn tour or our Fermented New York Craft Beer Crawl. I mean, we're really targeting, you know, not the beer geeks, but sort of the casual beer drinker, people who like to drink good beer but may not know a lot about it yet. And we have a lot of people come up to us and say, I'm not a beer drinker, or I don't like hoppy beer. And I immediately know they really haven't tasted the broad range of beers that are out there, because in their mind, they're thinking beer is either a Pilsner beer like Budweiser or Miller, one of those beers, or it's an IPA, because IPAs are so prevalent. And it's more so, it's an IPA with Cascade and Yakima hops, which is what everyone puts in their IPAs. But, you know, what we do is on the tours, we introduce them to a number of different flavors, different profiles that you can get with different hops. You know, one of my favorites is another local Brooklyn brewery, Kelso. They make their IPA with this Nelson Sauvignon hop, which is completely different than the Cascade hops. You know, whereas Cascade is grapefruity, citrusy, this hop really is like a berry flavor to it. And I've had people try this IPA and said, look, I've hated every other IPA I've had, but this is delicious. Because there's, you know, there's different varieties out there. So, you know, it's just like wine. We tell people that on the tours. Like,
Dave,
wine,
we love your deep voice. You talk right into the microphone. We love that.
Wine has different varieties, right?
He's smiling.
Different
grapes, if you can't see him,
flavors.
He's smiling now that I said that.
Yeah. He's a tour guide. He's got to have that voice.
Booming. That's what's necessary. On the streets of New York, it's necessary.
So hops are... So Sam, can you tell us about some of the different hops that are out there? So,
well, there's dozens and dozens, and you know, the contribution of hop to a beer is like the spice. So it's literally a dash. You don't need a ton of hops to do what's going to happen in the beer, but there are so many varieties. There's a lot of crosses, a lot of new things happening where they're splicing things and putting them together. But the key is with the hop is the more you learn about them, the more you can recognize them in different beers, and that's kind of fun, is to say, oh, you know, I see an English hop here, and you know, a Cascade over there, and
or something you've never tried before.
Yeah,
like what is that? Because I've been in hop fields with a bunch of brewers who were so excited about things called like 154A. You know,
right,
they're
right.
Not even
yeah.
named yet, but they just feel it coming, and they're getting something different from that hop varietal, just like Garrett went and tried this sriracha and was so inspired.
He knew exactly what beer to put
in. And his brain, knowing flavor so well and knowing how to meld flavors, he thought Saison and so brilliantly because sriracha is.
You know, Garrett says the minute he smelled and tasted that hop, you know, they put it in hot water and taste it. He said the recipe just appeared in his head for sriracha.
Like, it's like
that doesn't surprise
in
me.
Ring of Fire when Johnny Cash says, you know, I dreamt about Spanish trumpets before that song was produced. And it's you know, it's that instinct.
You know, another thing that's exciting is the rebirth of growing hops in New York State. Historically, New York State was the hop growing state in the United States prior to 1900, and they had a blight. And then the industry moved out to the Pacific Northwest. And now, with this whole growing movement of locally brewed beer, locally produced food and produce, brewers out here on the East Coast are demanding a local hop be grown. And the great thing about it is, you know, like a style like IPA, which has really been dominated by the West Coast brewers and the West Coast hops, you know, now the East Coast brewers are actually going to try and grow commercially some of different varieties of hops out here on the East Coast.
So what would be the East Coast hops, Steve?
Well, you know, there's a guy up in Geneva, New York, who actually found hops growing on his farm. And he is now propagating them and growing them. He's got a pretty good sized hop field. It's probably like half an acre. And we've been talking to him every year. I'm forgetting his name right now, unfortunately. But he has sold beer to Ithaca Brewing Company, and they've made some beers using those hops. And we're looking at the possibility. Rick Peterson, that's his name. We're looking at the possibility of working with Rick on this. So those, actually, some of the breeds he is using from out west or from Germany, but some are the native hops that were just growing wild on his farm. I think there's a great difference between an East Coast sense of beer and a West Coast sense of beer. The West Coast game seems to be, let's see if how many hops we can jam into a 12-ounce bottle of beer.
A big thing,
East Coast, I think we're more about balance, and we have great respect for the malt as well as the hop.
Well, the first, correct me if I'm wrong, but the first American like light lagers, German light lagers, were brewed in Brooklyn, right? I mean, there's so many more pockets of and the East Coast is full of pockets of German immigrants traditionally, and so. By the time people got to the West, it was just a free-for-all in many respects, and beer was probably one of them, too, where, you know, even though the tradition was based in Europe to begin with,
sure.
We've always been closer to the direct immigration.
But as a product, you know, there's nothing that traveled, I'm sure, more surely from East to West than beer did, you know, and so...
Yeah,
it got reinvented out there a little bit, but
exactly,
and kind of the Czechs and Germans love their malt and always have, and it's all about balance for them, and oftentimes delicate balance. And there was a quote about sort of extreme beers and how hoppy a beer can be, and I think Garrett said something really great about it. He said, a chef doesn't come to you and make the saltiest dish ever and say, well, this is the saltiest dish I can make because I put it in there, and hop is a seasoning, hops are a seasoning, so used judiciously. Yes,
right. Well, so. going back to Jen's point, and again, this is, you think of America, we've really been brewing good beer now for, just over 30 years in any kind of quantity. And what's neat about, when we were studying for the tour and learning about the history is if you go back and you look at the German immigrants that were coming here, they were bringing their local beer to America. And before that, the English were bringing in their local beer. And if you go to Europe now, there's still these local brewing traditions based on what grows there locally.
Do you think there's still a lot of secret places in Brooklyn to discover that are part of old 19th century brewing history?
Oh, yeah. And we're still finding them every day.
People can check that out on urbanoyster.com. They can go on some of your tours.
Yeah, the Brewed in Brooklyn tour, which, Steve is a font of knowledge for the history of beer brewing in Brooklyn, and we were lucky enough to get affiliated with Brooklyn Brewery early on when we started doing that tour. But Cindy and I keep trolling the records.
You definitely have to check out urbanoyster.com.
Yeah.
Go on one of Dave's tours. Check out the histories of Brooklyn breweries. Jen, any special events coming up at Blind Tiger?
We have a Saison event, as a matter of fact, tomorrow. It's Saison month for the Blind Tiger, and we've got some really fun stuff coming up. And then, we've got Urban Oyster transitioning into Rogue Oyster Fest next week.
All
Tuesday
right.
and Wednesday, we'll have a two-day event, so
that's
a fun one.
And Steve, anything special happening at Brooklyn Brewery?
Yeah, the next Brewmaster's Reserve is called The Tonic, and it's a collaboration with a young bartender here in Brooklyn, and it's based on his cocktail called the Penicillin. So,
right.
A little medicine for you.
That's okay. And Sam, anything going on with Civilization of Beer?
Well, classes that are published are all sold out. But I do want to mention that May 7th, this coming Saturday, is my lovely wife's birthday. So, happy birthday. And also, it's National Homebrew Day on Saturday. So, if you are a homebrewer and you want to bring people into the fold, that's kind of the official day brought on by the Brewers Association.
I think it's Derby Day, too.
It's also Derby Day. So, go to Brooklyn Ale House on Bedford Avenue and also also, I want to give a shout out to Balto, the dog from Brooklyn Ale House, who passed last week at 14 years old. And he was the famous Guinness drinking dog that made the dog bar of Brooklyn a dog
Mazel
bar.
Tov. I'd like to thank our sponsors, greatbrewers.com. Thanks to them, Good Beer Seal. You can also find Beer Sessions Radio on Facebook. Thanks to Jen, hey Ray, Steve, David, Sam, and Cindy for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Bree O'Connor. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
Roll out the barrel.
Thanks, guys.
And lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.